The Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Ms. Sherrill, please call the roll.
Chair Plasencia.
Here.
Vice Chair Mariano.
Here.
Representatives Grieco, excused. Hawkins.
Yes, here.
Joseph. Maney.
Yes.
McCurdy.
Here.
Nixon. Rizzo. Rodriguez. Rommel.
Here.
Schoaf.
Here.
Ranking Member Thompson. Tuck.
Here.
Zika.
Here.
You have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
A quorum being present, I want to welcome everyone to the Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee. Please make sure that cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or on silent mode. Pursuant to House protocols, please wear a face mask, including while providing testimony. Welcome, members. Today, I will be presenting our budget proposal and the conforming bill. The packet and meeting materials are now available on the House website. First, we'll take up the chairman's proposal. The first spreadsheet you have before you has an explanation of each item for fiscal year 21-22. Behind the blue divider, you'll find a spreadsheet for authorized reversions. I'm going to give a brief presentation on the highlights of the fiscal year 21-22 budget. If you have any further questions, please contact our staff. The full appropriations bill will be published at a later date and will go through the usual amendment process. Members, it goes without saying that as a state and as a nation, we face unparalleled economic challenges. I am proud to say that the budget I'm presenting today balances our responsibility as stewards of public dollars with our responsibility to prepare the next generation of workers, caregivers, entrepreneurs, and leaders. As you see here, the majority of our state's general revenue is in pre-K-12, healthcare, and higher education. Nobody wants to cut classroom teachers, critical healthcare services, or our post-secondary programs, but these are tough decisions we're faced with. Let me be clear. This higher education budget is not a slash and burn budget. Yes, we've made some tough decisions and it will be a lean year for many, but at the end of the day, the core capacity of Florida's higher education system will not suffer. The Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee overall budget totals is $7.9 billion. $4 billion is from general revenue, $1.5 billion is in lottery, and $2.4 billion is in trust funds. This represents approximately a 7% decrease in funds from the current fiscal year appropriations. Even after the reductions I'll go over shortly, as you can see, the university system still has the lion's share of state funds at 45.5%. So this slide just gives you an overview of the appropriations. As you can see, we have a decrease of $593 million, or essentially a 7% decrease. I'm not going to go into too much detail in here because it's up there, and I know everyone here has the ability to read, so I'm not going to read it to you. But one of the things I do want to highlight, or a number of the things I want to highlight, is the fourth bullet that says no current year reductions to colleges or universities. That's the 6% holdback that we talked about in earlier subcommittees. The governor decided, just as the pandemic was starting here in our state, to hold back 6% of the funding across the board to all silos, higher education being one of them. What we have chosen to do is to go ahead and give back the 6% after the fourth quarter. So that isn't happening right now, but in our budget, it's detailed that it will go back to our institutions. Another thing I want to bring to your attention is at the bottom where it says $14.2 million to fully fund current year Bright Futures deficit. Another item that we discussed in an earlier subcommittee was that we had a $14.2 million deficit in Bright Futures for the year we're currently sitting in, not for next year. And in this budget, we're funding that $14.2 million to make sure that we keep Bright Futures whole for the students that are utilizing those dollars in this fiscal year. This slide shows the primary reductions. As you can see, $556.4 million is to the state university system. These reductions are not across the board. Major university funding programs such as performance funding and preeminence were evaluated and adjusted to align with revenue estimates. We'll get into the details on the private college reform in the next slide. And the Bright Futures textbook stipend applies only to the very top tier of Bright Futures and provides $300 per term, up to $600 per year. We've made great strides in textbooks affordability in recent years, and as discussed on the previous slide, we're focusing on open access textbooks that can be utilized by all students, not just a select few. Members, you may recall back in February, we held a committee meeting where we saw presentations from the Florida Department of Education and ICUF regarding the EASE and ABLE tuition assistance grant programs. These programs, as we heard during the presentations, provide students enrolled at private institutions an average award amount of $2,841. EASE, the larger of the two, provides these grants to students at not-for-profit institutions, while ABLE, the smaller, provides grants to students at for-profit institutions. I was surprised, as many of you were as well, to see some of the data presented to us at that time. As you can see in the table presented here, our evaluation revealed poor performance among many institutions currently receiving state funds. In some cases, we have state dollars going to schools where fewer than 1 in 5 students graduate within 6 years. Given the severity of our economic situation, I cannot, in good conscience, continue to provide public funds for the benefit of private for-profit institutions. Nor can I justify encouraging students to take on significant debt in order to attend not-for-profit institutions that provide worse outcomes at a higher cost than our public institutions. For these reasons, I've recommended the elimination of the ABLE program and new institutional eligibility requirements for EASE, as outlined in the conforming bill you received a few days ago. These reforms will increase accountability and efficiency in our tuition assistance grant program and ensure the best outcomes for our students. As we consider the recommendations presented here, it is important to take them in appropriate context. This slide represents estimated stimulus allocations of federal aid from CARES and other federal legislation to both students and institutions. As you can see, when federal aid dollars are taken into account, each entity is net positive despite our reductions. Further, in some cases, institutions are authorized to utilize these funds into fiscal year 23-24, ensuring our institutions will remain stable in the coming years. Members, please turn to the reversion sheet behind the blue divider. The authorized reversion sheet includes just under $500,000 in immediate reversions for the fiscal year 2021 from the Board of Governors. I have worked closely with staff and the Board of Governors to identify reductions based on review of release holdback. Members, the recommendations presented today prioritize the needs of students and the broader economy while right-sizing our recurring revenues for a structurally sound budget. We've made substantial investments in our economic future with initiatives like the Open Door Grant Program and state university incentives for programs of strategic emphasis, both of which promote the development of high-demand and high-wage skills. We've eliminated public subsidies of university efforts in pursuit of prestigious rankings so that we can protect vital programs like Bright Futures and workforce education programs that help Floridians get back to work. With our reduction to revenues from distance learning fees and our investment in the Florida Postsecondary Academic Library, we are prioritizing structural investments in our higher education system while passing on savings to our students. Members, are there any questions? Ranking Member Thompson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I want to be sure that I understand the impact of eliminating E's and how that will affect our minority-serving institutions. I come from a background where I didn't have a family that had money, and when I started college, I went to class from 8 to 1 and worked from 2 to 10. So I'm always concerned and sensitive to financial assistance that students need. And I understand the graduation rates and the metrics that you have, but at the same time, are we considering that many of these students are Pell eligible and still have to work and therefore may not complete within 6 years? What impact will eliminating E's have on these low-income individuals?
Thank you, Ranking Member. And that's an excellent question and something that we looked at thoroughly. So first, we're not eliminating E's. What we've created, we're eliminating ABLE. And what we've done with E's is we've created a performance matrix to make sure that the institutions that are able to utilize the E's dollars and the students can use E's at those institutions are performing at a level that gives value to the money that's being spent by those students. Another thing that may not have been mentioned is also the amount of student debt that a lot of our students are accruing over the years at all institutions, not just institutions in ICUF. And there are great institutions within ICUF. We're not saying that all of the institutions within ICUF are performing poorly. Some of them are performing tremendously. But what we want to make sure is that kids who are coming from underserved communities, all residents of the state of Florida, if they're investing their time, their efforts, and accruing debt in gaining a higher education to better their lives, we want to make sure that that money isn't being wasted and they're not accruing debt with no value in return. And so we want to make sure that through this performance matrix that the schools that we are, or the students that we are investing in, and those dollars are then going to those institutions, are institutions that are providing value to those students.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think I misspoke. What I really want to understand is when you use the metrics that you propose with regard to affordability, retention, graduation, and employment, how will that affect the low-income students and many of the minority-serving institutions?
So it'll have a number of effects. First of all, those students are still available for need-based aid. But I think the larger point, and I think I touched on it in the last question, in my answer to the last question, is making sure that there is value in the degree that these kids are earning. But as you can take a look in those metrics, if you have a 17% graduation rate, and now you have a student who goes to one of these schools that isn't performing very well, there is a more than likely scenario that they're not going to receive a diploma from that institution, but they are going to accrue debt in the form of student loans. We're doing a disservice to our students by giving them that option with state dollars to go to those institutions where they can decide to go to a state college, which is much more affordable, or another institution that has a much more positive outcome statistically for students.
Yes, thank you. Do we know how many of these students graduate in 7 years or 8 years? The measurement here is that they must graduate within 6 years. And many of them stop out. They work, they earn money, they come back. Do we have statistics regarding what happens beyond 6 years?
Thank you, Ranking Member. So it's important to understand that when we compared these performance matrix or these performance standards to those of our state university and to our state colleges, we were comparing their 6-year graduation rates to our 4-year graduation rates. So they're still performing significantly lower than our public institutions, both university and state, on the graduation rates with 2 additional years to graduate. The 6 years is what the ICUF schools are measured by. If I'm not sure if we have 7 and 8 year graduation rates, and I'm not sure, and I believe that Mr. Boyd will be speaking on the conforming bill, and I think that's something he may be able to answer as a representative of the ICUF schools.
Thank you, and if you would, I have another question. Last session, we appropriated recurring dollars, and they were called gap funding for historically Black colleges and universities. And how will the proposals that we're considering today impact those funds through gap funds?
Thank you, ranking members. So it's important to note that the $20 million that we appropriated last year in the base recurring for our private HBCUs is in our budget. And so the private HBCUs did not lose that money. If in comparison to our state universities who lost their recurring base dollars at the tune of $140 million. So your historically Black colleges and universities that are private were able to retain those dollars.
Thank you very much.
Members, any other questions?
One question.
Representative McCurdy, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question in regards to the EES. If EES is reduced or eliminated, are there other grants that the state may offer to students who, that want to achieve education without falling into the cycle of, you know, applying for student loans and having been encumbered with student loan debt once they graduate?
Thank you, Representative McCurdy. So the answer is yes. So at the EES institution, they're still eligible for the FSAG, which is the need-based grants that the state offers. One second. In addition to that, they're also eligible for Bright Futures if they qualified to use their Bright Futures scholarship at those institutions. But I think the greater point, Representative McCurdy, is we want to make sure that we're giving students in the state of Florida viable options to be able to provide for their families. When you have performances, when you have some of these institutions that are performing at such a low level, and these kids, you know, a lot of these students, even if they do qualify for EES, even if they do qualify for FSAG, because of the cost of some of these institutions, they're still having to take out student loans. And we want to make sure if they're going into debt that they're able to pay back those debts. If you have a 17% graduation rate or 28% or 30% or even a 45% graduation rate, there's a lot of students that are going to walk away from their studies without having a degree and not being able to pay back or at least having a hard time of paying back those student loans. Members, are there any other questions? Representative Nixon, you're recognized for a question.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks for talking with me earlier this morning. I really appreciate it. You provided some clarity. Just for more clarity, can you tell me how you decided to calculate as it relates to the elimination of some of this operational support? Just what were your rationale in regards to it? Like, did you have a weighted system? Like, what happened? How did that happen?
Representative Nixon, can you be a little bit more specific with the question?
I'm just looking at just... don't worry about it. We're good. Yeah.
Members, are there any other questions? Vice Chair Mariano, you're recognized for a comment.
Thank you. And just relating to some of the questions about EES, many of you may know that I am probably one of the biggest proponents of EES that we have here in the state. At least that's what I like to say. But I think what the goal of this budget is to make sure that this is a student-focused budget that is looking at making sure our students are getting what they're paying for. And I think there can be a greater discussion on these metrics and like making sure they're the right metrics and that we're not leaving out students that we shouldn't be leaving out from these dollars, But I think at the end of the day, it makes sense as we're looking at where we have to cut, because we all know we have to make cuts, that we are cutting from places that are not going to hurt students and really providing them the best higher education that we possibly can. So I just wanted to say thank you for your work in this, and I hope it will be an ongoing discussion as to how these metrics move forward, but I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Mariano. Members, anyone else for questions or comments? Representative Joseph, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just circling back on the EASE program. So it provides financial assistance to students to attend private colleges, including low and moderate income students. Based on upon your research or staff's research, do you know what percentage of students would be affected by the reduction of EASE?
So are you asking overall for the entire system of students who are currently receiving EASE dollars?
Correct.
So I can tell you how many institutions are impacted, and it's there's 16 institutions that right now would not qualify to utilize the EASE dollars.
Okay, so it's based primarily on the institutions and not necessarily the students?
That is correct.
Okay. For these institutions, so I know certain institutions cater more towards or have a greater student population that consists of low or moderate income students versus, you know, not. Of these institutions, would you say more than 50% of them, of these institutions, of the 16 you just identified, would you say all or most of them, their student body is more than 50% low to moderate income?
No, we would not.
Do you have that information, or is that just an educated guess?
Both. We do have the information, and based off the information we have, we're pretty certain with that answer.
Okay.
And you'll have access to that information as well.
All right. That's it for now. Thank you.
Ranking Member Thompson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to suggest, as the matrix are being solidified, unless they're already etched in stone, I'd like to suggest that Pell eligibility be considered as one of the matrix by which you measure the institutions.
Thank you, Ranking Member Thompson. And to your point, that's the access piece of the matrix.
So access includes Pell eligibility.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Members, any other questions or comments? Members, our next order of business is to take up our budget conforming bill. At this point, I will ask Vice Chair Mariano to take over so I can present the PCB.
Thank you, Chair. You are recognized to explain PCB HEA 21-01 relating to higher education.
Thank you, Chair Mariano. Members, this bill conforms applicable statutes to the appropriations provided in the House proposed General Appropriations Act of fiscal year 2021-22. The bill specifies that all funds appropriated for preeminent state research universities must be distributed equally, eliminates the state university professional and graduate degree excellence program, provides minimum performance standards for institutions to be eligible to participate in the EASE program, eliminates the ABLE program, expands the existing faculty salary cap from state university administrative employees to include all university faculty, excluding those in specified high-demand fields, and creates the Florida Integrated Library System, which is the substance of House Bill 847 by Representative Byrd, recently passed by this committee, to provide funding for critical library services, a distance learning catalog, and a transient student and transient student applications. And that is the bill.
Thank you. Seeing no amendments, do we have any questions on the PCB? Seeing no questions, any public testimony? If have Tracy Ray with Independent Colleges and Universities of Florida waving in opposition. And we have Mr. Bob Boyd. You are recognized. Thank you for being with us today. I'm not sure if your mic is on.
Is it on?
There you go.
Chair Placentia, Vice Chair Mariano, members of the committee, I really appreciate you giving me the time to speak today. First of all, I'd like to say that Chair Placentia has been very gracious with his time. We've talked about this bill, we've talked about these issues, and we really appreciate it. We appreciate his willingness to help the 160,000 students that attend the ICUF schools. And I do appreciate the budget challenges you face, believe me. I have some comments I want to make about the PCB, but I do understand the situation you're in. Starting online, and by the way, I know that several of you attended ICUF schools. I think UM, Nova, Stetson, and St. Leo. You probably likely received the EES back then. It was probably called the FRAG, the Florida Resident Access Grant. So you know how important this program is, and I just would like to make a few comments on the PCB. Starting on line 538 of this bill, it limits choice in higher education, and this does take money out of the pockets of students. It's balancing the budget on the backs of students. This is a student grant, and if you look at the staff analysis, you'll see that students in 16 of the ICUF schools would no longer be eligible to get the EES, and actually it would reduce the award to 12,826 students, which is about 31.5% of the students at the ICUF schools. So this cuts the ICUF schools eligibility in half and then pulls the grant from about one third of all the students. The way I look at the staff analysis, we're drilling down on the data right now on the metrics to confirm those numbers, but I'm just quoting from the staff analysis at this point. A couple points. This money follows the student. This EES is an access grant. It's not an institutional grant. The state university and the state colleges, which are driven by metrics, get institutional funding. This is funding that goes directly to the student, and then the student decides where to attend. The funding reduces tuition by the exact amount of the EES. So again, just to make the point, we do not penalize a student, or why would you penalize a student based on the metrics of the school if the student decides to attend an Edward Waters or a Hodges or a Bethune-Cookman or a Berry or a St. Thomas University? So one of the issues we have is, you're taking money away from students based on a school's retention rate or graduation rate. And I'll get to that in a minute, why there's concerns on those metrics. Again, EES was passed in 1979. It was called the Florida Tuition Voucher then. It's higher ed choice. This is higher ed choice. Florida has historically embraced choice in K-12 and higher ed, and yet you're putting new limitations on higher ed and imposing new costs on students. And, what's interesting is we don't impose these metrics on the K-12 schools in the Florida voucher programs in the K-12 field. So, in the K-12 voucher programs. Another point is that ICUF strengthens our state's workforce. And right now we're in, a year of the pandemic. Florida is trying to supercharge its economy. We're laser focused on developing a skilled workforce. We want to get students back to work. And this PCB goes in the completely opposite direction. Florida's at a pivotal point in its economy, and we have a shortage of teachers and nurses and engineers and pilots. So this bill goes in the opposite direction, and actually taking money from students who need it the most to help them stay and graduate seems like a wrong-headed direction if you want to actually improve those metrics. Couple other quick points. The EES voucher makes colleges affordable. You will hear again and again from students that they would not be able to go to these institutions without the EES. They package the EES with Pell, PSAG, Bright Futures, which enables them to go. If you take away the EES grants from the students, you're increasing their tuition, and then you're also increasing their student debt. Two other quick points. limiting the eligibility for EES actually could cost the taxpayers more. So where are these students going to go? If the student drops out of St. Leo and they go to the state university, the taxpayer will pay more. For $2,841 a student, you're getting access and creating a bachelor's degree. If that student goes to UCF, the in-state tuition is $6,500, but the real cost to the taxpayer is probably $25,000 because the UCF is highly subsidized and there's a state subsidy that pays the difference and the taxpayers pay that bill. There is no metrics on that subsidy. So if you really want to compare apples to apples, you should apply metrics to that state subsidy. And that's why you actually are getting a better return on the investment through EES than if that student were to go to UCF. And I provided information at the last committee. For every $1 million spent to the taxpayer, the state gets 305 baccalaureate degrees from the ICUF institutions and 41 from the state public institutions. In answer to Representative Thompson's question, nearly 50% of the EES students are low income. If these metrics pass, it's likely that every ICUF school that has 45% or more minorities will lose eligibility for EES. Again, we've got to drill down on the data. The other quick point, and I promise I'll wrap it up, Mr. Chair, is the debate in the Senate over Bright Futures. The question was, if these students lose these Bright Future dollars, they projected that they would get this funding for 4 years, and that's why they made the decision to attend the institution they attend. Same thing with EES. You're pulling money away from students in year one. They've made a decision to attend St. Leo or Embry-Riddle because they think they're getting the full EES award for 4 years. So perhaps one thing to look at is when we implement this change and maybe do it 4 years from now. Let me just talk real quickly on the metrics. So, Representative Mariano brought up this point, but there may be some flaws in the metrics. For example, on student placement rates, what if a student goes to grad school out of state, or the student works out of state or becomes self-employed? How do you calculate in those students? On graduation rates, do you include transfer students? I don't think you do. And how do you capture that data? Why is there no exemption for a student who continues their education in another school? And the other issue I thought was interesting is, and Representative Thompson brought this point up, based on the metrics, ICUF schools would need to be serving close to 45% Pell eligible to continue to receive the EES. And then the other metric says you've got to limit the amount of student loans on an annual basis to $8,000. Well, you can't do both. Those are opposite goals. And by the way, the federal law does not permit an institution to limit or deny the full amount of federal student loans. So there are some issues on the metrics we could work with. And one other point on the metrics. For small schools, these are schools with 4,000 or 5,000 students. So let's say a football coach is fired and six students who are football players leave. For every student in a school under 6,000 students, with regard to retention rate, if you drop one student, it's a whole percentage point. So we're talking about very small schools. If six students leave UCF, there is no impact at all on their percentage on some of these metrics. One last point I want to make, one issue is, when you look at our sector as a whole, our graduation rate, for example, is only 10 percentage points below the state university sector. Yes, there are schools that have much lower rates, but what do you expect from those schools if they're serving underserved students and students that are not traditional, that are single moms, that are working adults, that are older students? So, of course, the graduation rate is going to be lower at those schools. But when you look at the whole sector, we're close on graduation rates within 10% and actually almost equal to the state universities on retention rates. So for those reasons, Mr. Chair, I would just say Florida is a dynamic place. We're growing. We need to have a talented workforce. The EES grant, in our opinion, should remain as it is written. It's a market-driven approach. It's got great ROI, and it serves students who choose the schools they go to and based on their best needs in Florida. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Joseph, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned a couple of schools, one of which was Berry University. Can you elaborate a little bit more on what the impact of the proposed budget changes would have on a school like that?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I don't have the specific data. You know, I'm going by what the staff analysis says, and we're looking at the data. But Berry, for example, is a majority Hispanic university. So who Berry serves is much different than who the University of Florida serves. It's not your traditional 18-year-old student. This could be a first time in college, first generation in college, a needy student, a working mom. So I think you got to look at the populations of the institutions instead of just looking at an overall metric and trying to get to that goal.
What, Madam Chair?
You're recognized.
Earlier when I was trying to ask the chair questions about the impact on low to moderate income students, by eliminating this particular program, it was tied to the institution as opposed to the university. I mean, as opposed to the student itself. And as you just testified, it's tied to the student because it's based on their income and eligibility, which then they go ahead and pick the institution. My question for you is how, of the students who receive the EES grant currently, what percentage of those would you say are low to moderate income students?
And just before you answer, Representative Joseph, this does not, you said it eliminates the program, which does not eliminate the program, as well as the metrics are based on the institution's performance, not the student's performance. Were they taken accessibility as part of the metric, but the metrics are not student-based, but you're free to answer the question.
Okay. Then I'll ask a follow-up based on that clarification.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, you're exactly right. The metrics are based on the institution's performance, but the grant goes to the student. So if the student shifted an institution, that money would follow the student. But to answer your question, of the EES students, was it on a specific institution or overall?
Right now, overall.
Okay, 40% received Pell Grants.
Okay.
In its sector at wide of the EES students.
Okay. So
do you have a follow-up?
I do, Madam Chair.
You're recognized.
Thank you. Based on your clarification earlier, I guess going back to those 16 institutions that are targeted based on the proposed changes, what percentage of those institutions, their student makeup is predominantly low and middle income?
You're recognized.
I would just have to speculate because I don't know the list of institutions yet. So I can't really answer the question. I think it would be a significant number, but I can't give you a percentage because I don't know the institutions.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
We will move into debate on the PCB. Members, do we have any debate? Representative Joseph, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you. I guess if in closing, the chair could address, you know, what can we do for these students that are currently receiving these programs? As you've heard from the testimony, a lot of them have made their decisions for the institutions that they've made on at least a four-year time schedule of maybe considering delaying the implementation out for 4 years, or particularly for students, or figuring out something for the students who are already receiving that and have made life decisions based on that, including, you know, where to attend school. Just want to make sure that we're not losing people in the cracks in whatever we're trying to accomplish, and they're not paying the unintended consequences. So thank you.
Thank you. Ranking Member Thompson, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I think with regard to the matrix, we are coming up with a measure and applying it equally across institutions. I believe, however, we should be looking at equitable rather than equal. And equitable would mean we'd have to take into consideration some other factors in order for the metrics to be fair. And those considerations include the fact that many students are commuter students who attend some of the low-income minority-serving institutions. They have jobs, they have families, and so it's a different population that is not like the measure that we want to apply to it. And so I have some serious concerns regarding decreasing ease and making really the student accountable. But we say it's based on the institution, but it's the students who are going to suffer. And if our goal is to educate and to train people to go into the workforce, this doesn't get us there. So I'm hoping that we can go back and revisit the whole issue of these measures so that we don't unfairly penalize students who have different challenges in their lives than some others who the metrics may fit. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I will just quickly debate. Thank you, Chair, for your hard work on this issue. I know you and your staff have been looking at this and working on this to make sure it was not done rashly, and it was very deliberative. I would appreciate, as we move through the process here, just, you know, looking at these metrics and making sure that we are really making sure our students are going to institutions and that are going to be able to provide them with the education they need to be successful in the workforce. And I think that's the intent. That's what I've gathered the intent to be, is to not leave students out to dry with no scholarship, but to make sure that they are going to institutions where they're going to have outcomes that are going to lead for them to have high skilled jobs and employment and as low of debt as possible. So I appreciate your work on this issue and look forward to working with you in the future. And with that, you are recognized to close.
Thank you, Madam. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for all of your thoughtful comments and questions as well. I know this can tend to be a difficult process, especially with the amount of money that we're cutting. But I do want to make a couple of points. First, I think it's interesting how much time we're spending on, not that there isn't value, because I do value what EASE does and what it provides to many of our families, and I have a lot of respect for a lot of our EASE institutions or ICUF institutions, because there's some great universities and colleges within the ICUF network. But I do want to point out that we're looking at cutting $556.4 million from our state university system that serves so many more students. But yet we have focused on the $41.1 million that are being cut to private college tuition and assistant grant programs and reforms. And so I think that's a concern of mine, because we should be looking at some of the other cuts that we're making as well, but we're spending a lot of time on this. Having said that, I do want to address some of the concerns that were brought up on the changes we're making to EASE. First, I do want to point out in your packet as well, in the PowerPoint, the private colleges and university have $281.2 million in federal emergency relief funds that have been sent down from the federal government because of the pandemic. That's $281.2 million. That's money that can be spent over the next 2 years, not just this year, but it can be spent in the next year and the year after that. That is a substantial amount of money to make sure that these universities and colleges have the ability to keep educating their students and the students who choose to stay there. I also want to address some of the comments made by Mr. Boyd. And he had mentioned the comparison between our K-12 voucher schools and this school choice program that we have here at the higher education level, and said that there isn't anything comparable, but actually there is. We do have a method of eliminating funding or a private school from receiving vouchers at the K-12 system. If they're found to be in any violation to any of the accountability measures that we have set forth in our K-12 regulations and laws, then they're not going to be eligible to receive those vouchers from those students. Much like what we're instituting here and making sure that there's a certain level of accountability when taxpayer dollars are being spent at a private institution. He says that it makes college affordable. You know, when you take a look at the affordability of some of these schools and you compare it to our state colleges and even our state universities and our public colleges are still more affordable, even if you have the EES. And so when you're talking about, and I've talked about this a number of times, the amount of student loan debt that we have to take that into consideration. We have students that are accruing debt, but they're not getting a viable product for that debt that they're accruing. At the very least, we know that our state universities, which are ranked, and our state colleges combined, are ranked number one in the nation. We know the quality of that project, or of that product, I'm sorry. In fact, when you take a look at six-year graduation rates in comparison between IKUV schools and our public universities, the IKUV schools have a 47.9% average graduation rate, where our state university system has a 75% graduation rate if you compare 6 years to 6 years. That is a substantial difference between our IKUV schools on the average and our state universities on average. Another thing I'd like to mention is all of this data was data that was provided to us by IKUV. It wasn't data that we created ourselves. It was data that was provided to us by IKUV because we asked them for it. And it's also important to understand and take note that each institution only had to meet 3 out of the 5 measurements or criteria. So if they were performing low on 1, or 2, they still are eligible to be EES eligible. It's when they're performing bad on 4 or 5 of the measurements that they're no longer eligible. And that should be concerning for us as well. And Representative Joseph, I forgot what comment you wanted me to address in my closing. I apologize, but I did write it down. Is it okay, Madam Chair, if she, thank you.
You're recognized.
Sure. I'm just trying to figure out what we're going to do for, and I mentioned specifically for the EES students, whether we can delay the implementation, what other provisions. It was kind of like a follow-up on Representative McCurdy's question. But, you know, I highlighted EES, but EES isn't the only program, right? EES is the one that we've been focusing on in some of the questioning. And to your point about, you know, the larger budget, but looking at pages 1 through 1 of the proposed, like, line item budget, there are lots of other programs that have been significantly impacted beyond EES. So I'm just looking at the students. So we're talking about EES, but beyond EES, like, what are we doing for those so they don't get penalized for the institutions, whatever?
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're okay. Finish your close.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Joseph. I think one of the things that we really need to look at is the $281.2 million that the private colleges and universities have received through the higher education emergency relief allocations. That's money that can be used next year and the year after, much like you would use EES. I still think it's important to understand that we need to keep the student centered. We need to keep the have a certain amount of accountability on not just the money that's coming from taxpayers, but the money that students are spending in the form of student loans. In closing, I do want to mention this is a very difficult process for all of us. When we came into the first committee stop of committee weeks, we looked at the numbers: $2.7 billion shortfall, $357 million, which was our prorated amount for higher education. We knew that there would be some tough decisions that we would have to make. This is a process that we're in. This is a process that is inclusive of everyone, and we take everyone's recommendations and comments and backgrounds into consideration, both from the membership and from the community at large. This is only the beginning. We're going to work on this budget, but understand that there's been a lot of work put into this budget, a lot of thought put into this budget, and it's always difficult when you have to cut money as opposed to give money. But at some point, we have to do what's responsible when cutting those dollars to make sure that we set forward a path for future Floridians, for our children and our grandchildren, to make sure that they have a prosperous state as we do now.
Chair Vicencia, having closed, Ms. Sherrill, will you please call the roll on PCB HEA 21-01?
Chair Vicencia?
Yes.
Vice Chair Mariano?
Yes.
Representatives Grieco? Hawkins?
Yes.
Joseph?
No.
Maney?
Yes.
McCurdy?
Yes.
Nixon?
Yes.
Rizzo?
Yes.
Rodriguez? Rommel?
Yes.
Schoaf?
Yes.
Ranking Member Thompson?
No.
Tuck?
Yes.
Zika?
Yes.
11 yeas, 2 nays.
By your vote, shall PCB HEA 21-01 will be reported favorably. And I will pass the gavel on back. Congratulations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, as we move forward, you're going to be probably receiving a lot of emails and phone calls from constituents, potentially from a university in your district or a state college or an ICOF school. If you have any questions whatsoever, I am available at any time of the day. Everyone should have my cell phone number. I know our staff is available as well to answer any questions and, of course, to receive any feedback that you may have to try to make this budget better and reflective of what we want to see our state higher education institutions and programs look like. So I appreciate everyone's patience. I appreciate everyone's input over the last couple of months that we've been meeting, and I look forward to continuing this conversation and finalizing this budget as we move into this next month. This concludes our committee agenda. Is there any further business before the committee? Seeing none, Representative Zika moves we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.